to Nerds Amalgamated. I'm the professor and my co-host is a DJ. How have you been going, DJ?
I've been good. I've just been enjoying myself watching the Milk Crate Challenge videos that's been popping up the internet these days.
Oh, boy. Look, I know you're pretty dumb sometimes, but please tell me you're not that dumb.
What? I just want to see the fun and the hype and all this, the fanfare and everything. Just
don't try to do it.
Oh, I'm not going to do it. No, hell no. With all the people screaming in pain after doing that, like, I don't want to do it.
Good.
I mean, it's not even for a worthy cause, if I recall. Not like the Ice Bucket Challenge.
No, the Ice Bucket Challenge was significantly less likely to harm you than the Milk Crate Challenge. Like, there might have been one or two people who had heart attacks or hypothermia or something, but I don't think I've seen a single Milk Crate Challenge video where somebody hasn't gotten hurt. But speaking of hurting people, our first topic tonight is about aggression in video games, and it's not what you're probably thinking. You're probably thinking we're going to go on with that tired old argument about whether games cause violence.
I can hear Jack coming, looking out in the window going, someone talking about me?
Yeah, screw that guy. And that organization, Mothers Against Video Games, or whatever it was called.
Oh, yeah.
So, I've come across this paper on the connection between real-world circumstances and online player behavior, specifically in EVE Online. So, they've gone through EVE Online and collected data based on the violent acts and the economic acts that players engage in. So, violent acts are obviously killing people, fighting enemies. Economic acts are trading and collecting resources. And they found some really interesting correlations here. So it's not clear which way around goes, but people who live in a place that is more violent are less aggressive in video games. So is that because they're using it as an escapism from their real world problems? Or is it because video games are the people who are violent in video games then don't go out and kill people in real life?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, normally people play video games as a form of escaping, and you would assume that they know that you cannot kill people in real life because it's illegal.
Well, not just because it's illegal, because it's kind of a mean thing to do.
Yeah. So what are the other findings?
Killing people is pretty bad.
Oh yeah. So what other findings did they find in that report besides this nugget?
There's a line I missed when I read it earlier. We have observed a positive relation between in-game aggressiveness against NPCs and real-world aggressiveness. So there's actually a difference depending on whether you're interacting with a human or an NPC. People who are from more violent countries tend to be more violent to NPCs.
So from people from more violent countries tend to be more violent towards the NPCs,
but not to other humans. Okay. They're less violent to other humans. So maybe we should be keeping an eye on the kinds of people who like to make houses full of their enemies in The Sims.
Oh, that'd be funny. Can you imagine a game of Mortal Kombat, like when you're playing with friends, it's like it's all normal and kosher and everything professional. But when your friends are not there, it's like die, you friend. We win all the time, and I die.
Yeah, that's true. You play Mortal Kombat. I'm going to just move and not tell you where I'm going. They also analyzed trading data. So people from countries with higher unemployment and weaker currencies are more efficient and money-conscious in-game, which kind of makes sense. If you happen to live in a situation where you have to be careful with your money, you're probably going to see that carry over to role-playing as well. But they also found out that people who live in countries with weaker currency earn more in-game money. And their theory for that is that it's because in EVE Online, you can pay for your membership using in-game currency. I'm not sure how that works now, because EVE went at least partially free-to-play a few years ago. But this study is based on data from, I think, 2011 to 2016.
Ooh.
So it's a few years old, but I might have those dates wrong. I'm just trying to find them again.
Mind you, though, around if I recall, around that time, there were a couple of big contests. I remember EVE Online had a tournament which had a prize money worth $1 million, if I recall.
Okay. I don't recall that one.
Wait a second. Yeah, it's the $1 million battle. It was really hyped up, and
is that because people are winning money, or because it has $1 million worth of ships in it? Because technically, you can calculate the real world value of a ship in EVE, because you can tell that, you know, 10,000 of the in-game currency ISK, funnily enough, same acronym as the Icelandic krona. And the devs are from Iceland, so they clearly think that in the far future, Iceland will take over space.
But the result was it turned out to be $4,000 short.
Okay.
Or give us like a few hundred.
So you can calculate, you know, if a ship costs you, say, $1 million, then you can calculate how many months of membership that would be equivalent to, and then work out a real-world equivalent value.
Yeah. This was in 2018, mind you, so not within the realms of the study then. Hmm.
Okay. Yeah, so when you see articles about massive battles with millions of dollars worth of ships, that's the thing that they're talking about.
Hmm. And the other question would be, why EVE Online? Like, you could have done a much better study, like, if it was FIFA, for example.
Well, FIFA is a much more constrained game. EVE is a kind of sandbox. You can do whatever you want. You can be a pirate, you can be a soldier, you can be a trader or a miner. So it's more about researching what people choose to do in the game. Whereas in FIFA, you're obviously a soccer player, that's it.
Yeah, but with FIFA, you can get, there is a lot of money like generated it with that game alone. I mean, look at the Ultimate Team option, for example.
There is, but that's nothing to do with the study they're doing here.
That's true.
I think you'd likely see a correlation that people from poor countries don't spend as much on Ultimate Team, but that's a pretty common sense thing. Probably still worth researching, because a lot of common sense things... Oops, just dropped my keyboard. A lot of common sense things are not common sense and don't reflect reality. So it's still worth researching things.
Yeah. So what are the other stuff they've explored in the article?
So it's really just the violence and the economics.
I'm surprised not many organizations have done announcements when this report came out.
I don't think anybody really cares. It's a fairly academic topic. So apart from the people who want to make video games look bad by tying every school shooter to video games, because this actually makes video gamers look good. If video gamers tend to be less violent than people in real life. There is, though, a study that they've linked in their references. Violent video games and real-world violence, rhetoric versus data. In the US, violent crime decreases in response to the release of violent video games.
So, this whole notion of, like, oh, video games cause violence, this whole report and just blasts that narrative out of the window, basically.
Well, the violent video games report does.
Yeah.
This one doesn't, obviously.
From a game developer standpoint, when you see reports like these, does it affect you in a big sense, or I already knew this?
I think the main impact might be in marketing. If you're seeing that people are less violent in video games when they live in a violent place, maybe there's a correlation to be found there that they're more likely to play like chill games like Stardew Valley or Animal Crossing that don't have violence in them. But that would be probably a separate study.
Would also affect the games ratings as a whole.
No.
No?
I don't think it will. I think we're a long way from seeing any further changes in the rating systems because the people in charge of the rating systems tend to be older and not as receptive to making change to begin with, as evidenced by the many year-long battle to get an R18 rating for video games in Australia.
Oh, don't get me started on that drama.
Get you started? Don't get me started. Yeah, it's a case of, right, studies like this show that violent video games don't have an impact on making people violent, which you could maybe argue should mean that violent video games can be rated for younger children. But you're still going to get the think of the children people who don't want their four-year-old playing GTA 5. And yes, GTA 5 is almost certainly not appropriate for a four-year-old. But the people who you'd have to convince to get that sort of change made, I don't think would be interested in hearing that. And I don't know that we really need to. I mean, the R18 rating is now a thing in Australia. I think they're still a bit tight with it. There are games that can't be sold here because even though we have R18, they're still banned because they're so abhorrent. Most of them aren't that bad.
But you reckon this this report will give them a bit more, would give the ratings boards a bit more wiggle room in terms of like, okay, this may give us some...
Not like, immediately.
Not immediately?
No, give it another 10 or 20 years. Hopefully the people in the Bureau and responsible for classification around the world will cycle out and be replaced by younger people with more open views about this. But I think we need to wait for that to happen first. Because I think that's been one of the big things holding back things like the R18 rating in Australia, that the Bureau is a bunch of people, like older people. So they're clearly not going to be in touch with what the younger people are thinking. And it's definitely improved in the past 10 years since I first started learning about it. But the Bureau still tends to lean pretty conservative on ratings.
Yeah.
I do think it's really interesting, though, seeing how people react to events in games compared to how their real-world scenario is. And I think it could have value maybe in some psychological treatment, because I'm aware of people who become addicted to games because they feel like it's an area they have control over. That's a thought that I've heard a couple of times when I've researched games addiction, and it does seem to be something that I think would tie into this, because if you feel like you have no control in your real life because there's anarchy on the streets, your currency is worth nothing, maybe you're more likely to get sucked into a game. So maybe it would help psychologists treat that, but I really don't know what the other real-world applications of this could be. Marketing and psychology, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I can also maybe put something out there in terms of, it could also, how do I put this? It could also, take out the whole, take out the blurry line between, like, what really happens in the life of a gamer. And you know how when media always portray the gamers as like, oh, a bunch of smelly old dudes in the basement eating chips on a table and shit and stuff like that,
which hasn't been true for decades.
Yeah, yeah, and like, I think
statistically, if you count all games, including mobile games, the average gamer is like a 35-year-old woman, but middle-aged women tend to drift towards casual games like those Facebook games, Farmville and all that, and mobile games like Candy Crush, whereas there's also a demographic shift into action games as with younger people.
Yeah. I think this report will just blow that narrative out of the window in terms of, video games causes violence. Nope, this report just basically just disproves your argument right there.
No, I don't think so.
You don't?
No, I don't think it's it really proves that at all. I do think, though, that it would be really interesting to see this applied to more areas. So now we've covered violence and aggression and economics. I'd really like to see the same sort of study done on other topics. Like, are people who come from countries with good healthcare more likely to play medics? I don't know. I'm just coming up with random ideas now.
Can you imagine, like, all those countries playing Surgeon Simulator? I'm like, here we go.
Well, maybe people in the US play the really hardcore Surgeon Simulators, like the actual accurate ones, to learn how to do their own surgery so they don't have to go into debt.
Can you imagine, like, being hired by the mobsters, like, to be the doctor? It's like, how long have you been doing this medical thing for? I haven't been doing much. I just learned it from playing Surgeon Simulator.
Well, it depends. If it was Surgeon Simulator, I would hope not. They were not doing my medicine. But if it was one of the more specific ones, like the that game that was actually designed to train doctors to triage, then I'd feel a lot more comfortable.
Do you reckon they should have explored the other games instead, besides EVE Online, though? I mean, I think I might have circled this. I might have asked that question earlier, but yeah.
Yeah, I think EVE is a good choice because it has that variety. I'm not sure of any other games where you could have done that sort of economic simulation. I am aware of other studies using games to simulate things. There's the infamous Corrupted Blood incident in World of Warcraft. So in 25 words or less, not actually counting, a curse that a monster could put on you, Corrupted Blood, well, one of the bosses, could put a curse on you called Corrupted Blood, which would cause you to take damage over time. This was a fairly high-level dungeon, but people figured out that if you got Corrupted Blood on you, and then teleported out of the dungeon, it wouldn't reset and you would still have Corrupted Blood. So trolls would go and get Corrupted Blood and then run through town spreading Corrupted Blood to everyone they could. And we thought that was extremely unlikely people would run around spreading COVID to each other.
Yeah, a lot of people were comparing this to the COVID-19 pandemic, and boy, there is some eeriness.
Yeah,
I mean there are some other games like they could have explored, like COD, where even like the amount of craziness that happens in that game, or Madden.
Well,
for
COD's
example,
just one thing, it's just shooting people. You can't like choose not to shoot people. The thing is, the games that you pick to study need to be games where you can choose not to take part in a particular part of the loop. But COD is such a tight, directed experience, I don't think you could draw any useful conclusions from it. Because it's either kill people or be killed. And nobody plays a game like COD to be killed.
Yeah.
I do like the Corrupted Blood incident, though, that people were actually going into towns and spreading it, but there were also people going into towns and healing people. So we actually had people playing medics and trying to prevent the spread. And, you know, I remember when the first time I read about it, people were like, no, this isn't realistic at all because it's a game. Nobody cares if you die.
But it was an interesting experiment nonetheless.
Yeah, it's interesting. And that section that's been added to the Wikipedia page about comparison to COVID-19 is pretty interesting. One of the authors of the study said that They've built models of the social construction of risk perception, and they don't think they would have gotten that, wrapped their head around it quite as easily if they hadn't researched the Corrupted Blood incident.
So, at the end of it, so should there be more studies to this? I mean, you might have asked.
Yes. I want more studies into this sort of topic. I want to know more about how people react to things in-game based on their real-world experiences. And I wonder if the Corrupted Blood incident had happened in another year or two rather than back in 2005, if people would react differently because of COVID.
Mm.
But that's all takes a lot of work to do. You need to find a game that's popular and has a wide reach like EVE or World of Warcraft. You need an incident like that. It's hard to engineer that sort of scenario without tainting your data.
Well, okay, there will be other games like maybe Animal Crossing for one. What's another?
Which character in Animal Crossing is most likely to be trapped on a single tile by players who hate that character? I don't know.
But anyway, we should move it
along. What have you got for us tonight, DJ?
Sure. I was going to say, we could always. There is always Roblox.
Yes, Roblox coming up later.
Oh, yeah. You have a story about Roblox and how there is drama behind that.
Yeah, but first we're going to do the Nirvana Baby.
Oh, wait, give me a sec.
Have you read the show notes that you wrote?
Yeah, because it was actually the games, then Roblox, then Nirvana Baby. That's what I wrote.
What? Well, no, it's not, because I've got the thing here you sent me that says first video games, then Nirvana, then Roblox.
Ah!
Yeah, you're
fuck. Yeah, I boomered so badly. Yeah, I boomered so badly this time. Alright, so give me a sec.
It's always fun when I can't even get the DJ to pay attention to what he's done himself.
I know.
Like, seriously, your memory is so bad.
What's up, Sonny? What's that? I can't hear you. Back in my day, video games didn't cause violence.
Anyway, the Nirvana Baby, who is no longer a baby, to be clear.
So you know the Nirvana, right? The big band that had the song "Smells Like Teen Spirit," Kurt Cobain, and the craziness happened with that band. You know that story, right?
Yeah, I know all about that. Totally, that's totally the kind of music I'm into. So
you know the whole
the cover.
You
know the Nevermind, right?
Album, so the baby in that Nevermind album is named Spencer Eldon, and he recently filed a lawsuit alleging that the former members of the grunge rock trio, the record companies, artists, and everyone else have violated federal crime. Laws, causing him a lifelong suffering by trafficking his image worldwide.
So he's basically come out and saying they made child pornography of him for using his photo on the album cover, which I did hear there was when Nirvana were discussing whether they should edit the photo or not. Kurt Cobain said they should include a sticker that says, "If you're offended by this, you're probably a pedophile."
So Spencer was saying, like, he alleged that his identity and legal name are forever tied to this commercial sexual exploitation experience as a minor, which has been distributed and sold worldwide for the time he was a baby to the present day.
I kind of see his argument.
But here's the thing. Like, this whole image was circulated with the consent of his parents, presumably 30 years ago.
Nirvana bought it from his parents for $200.
Yeah. Actually, it was a photo shoot, actually.
They paid his parents $200 for the photo shoot and the rights to the photo.
Yeah.
So technically, he doesn't actually have any rights to the photo, which I think is why he's going after the child abuse angle.
Yeah, but then here's the thing, though. Like, he earlier on, he would when when he revealed like he was the baby, like he was proud about it. Until like years ago, 2016, he decided to change the tune a bit.
Yeah, so he's what, 30 years old now?
Yeah.
Thereabouts. And up until just a couple of years ago, he, you know, for the first 20 years, we'll cut him some slack because he was a child and not necessarily aware of the implications. But he has also, up until just a couple of years ago, done reenactments of the photo. He has Nevermind tattooed on his chest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's done. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. So it's coming across to me as a lawsuit for the money rather than for the actual principle of putting a naked baby on an album cover.
Yeah. And I was watching a couple of law videos about this. And here's the thing. Here are a couple of arguments. Okay. So it's 30 years ago, not sure there isn't really a federal statute of limitations when it comes to this risque material, but the real issue is that the guy knew the real issue is that the guy knew about this entire picture the whole time, and plus there was a whole, the guy was compensated, and the if this was a commercial I can't say those spicy words. If this was a very spicy image, everyone's complicit in it, like every
you
music.
You mean child pornography?
Yeah.
Words I literally said like 2 minutes ago.
That's
or
true.
Or CSAM, CSAM, however you want to pronounce it. I think the thing is they say child sex abuse material or something now, because I think the reasoning is that pornography has a connotation of being legal or consensual,
yeah,
because it's in a lot of the world it is legal,
yeah,
and consensual, apart from, you know, revenge porn and all that. But so advocates now want people to call it CSAM to make it seem more serious, I think.
Yeah, and here's the thing, like if this was a commercial child porn pornography stuff, then everybody's complicit in it. Like every music distributor, music retail store, everybody
his parents.
Yeah, so basically everybody who has the album, which would be like millions and millions of people, would have this album.
And there's also the argument, there's are parents who take pictures of their children who happen to be naked, because kids hate wearing clothes apparently, and I'm pretty sure every parent has photos of their children, like, as babies, naked. Does that count as CSAM or not?
Oh.
Yeah, it's something I've heard a bit of debate about it. Personally, I think it's not, because it's not sexualized. It's non-sexual nudity.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
His argument is that the album cover is sexualized. And do you know the reason why? Have you heard this quote yet, DJ?
No, I don't think I have.
So, the photo famously shows him chasing after a dollar attached to a fishing hook.
Yeah.
He says that the presence of the money and the baby chasing the money makes it prostitution.
I've heard that one. Yeah, that's what I've heard. I've heard another interpretation of that this whole baby chasing the money is a metaphor of life being dumped into the deep end and you're chasing the money, in a sense.
Yeah, or a criticism of capitalism. It's art. You can interpret it however you want.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like,
I'm not a big fan of Death of the Author, but realistically, you can interpret art however you want.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, there is, and the other thing is, it doesn't really meet the definition of child pornography in the federal sense in America, where the definition from the legal videos I've seen is basically a picture, image, or video or representation of said material that is sexually explicit, which does not require a child to be engaged in a sexual act, but it does require some level of intent for the image to be sexualized. The image, the intent behind the image is to derive a sexual pleasure, basically. So it's hard to argue that the album fits that definition. I mean, yeah, you're right. There is, it's open to interpretation. And those people who do find the, who find that really, who find that thing really pleasant, should deserve a bullet.
Yeah, I think if you're looking at, I think like Kurt Cobain said, if you're looking at a non-sexualized picture of a naked baby and thinking that's pornography, it falls on you.
Yeah,
and saying that's probably going to piss off some people listening, but if that pisses you off, that falls on you.
Yeah, yeah. And the stupid part about this whole debacle as well is he's done this multiple times. Like, he's done this when he was a 10-year-old. He's done this when he was a 30. He's a 20-year-old. Like, there's multiple images of him doing it.
Yeah, so the first couple, you know, he's a child and doesn't understand the gravity of it. But there are also reenactments he's done as an adult, which I think kind of show that, I think that supports that this is a bit frivolous, because it shows that it's only just now that he's suddenly got a problem with it, and that's why he's trying to sue, and he probably wants some money for it, which, yeah, understandable. A photo of you has gone around the world and you got $200 for it.
If he was to basically say, like, I feel like I should be paid more for the artwork and stuff, then yeah, sure, fine, okay, he should be paid more for the royalties and stuff. But this feels like, yeah, and plus, mind you, this is 15 named defendants for $150,000 each. That just
defendants. So that would be the band, the agencies, the studios, stuff like that, I assume.
Yeah, yeah. So everyone that got involved, basically. The photographer, to the parents, yeah.
Oh, he's suing his parents?
No, I don't think so, but I wouldn't run past that, though. But
yeah, that kind of wouldn't surprise me at this stage.
Yeah.
He's but suing everyone. Also,
yeah, but also does it, there is an interesting argument. You know those, what about those child actors and their, and when they acted in movies and stuff? You reckon there'll be, we might see this kind of a lawsuit as well?
I think from the aspect of should probably have been paid more royalties, yes. But I think it's hard to argue that many other movies with children in them are CSAM. Because, like, this is fairly obvious. It's a naked baby. You can make the argument that it's sexualized, with his frankly ridiculous argument that a naked baby trying to grab some money is a prostitute. But, you know, some movie with children in it, Jumanji, there's no nudity in that, obviously. The Parent Trap, there's no nudity in that. So I think maybe you'll see people arguing that they should have gotten more royalties, which, it's the same sort of lawsuit that Scarlett Johansson is taking against Disney at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, actually, just selling the rights for the photo outright was probably a bit of a mistake on his parents' part, because, you know, royalties on that photo, even if it's only a small percentage, would be a pretty tidy amount at this point. 30 years of selling one of the most well-known albums?
Oh,
I wouldn't say no to that money.
Imagine if he sold the original cover as an NFT. That would have made him a lot more money.
Oh, not NFTs. Don't bring that up again. We finally got rid of them. People finally stopped talking about NFTs. Don't make them come back. They're so wasteful. They're so wasteful and pointless.
But yeah, did you see the picture that he's done this reenactment? By the way,
Yes, he's in the wearing his shorts this time.
Yeah,
because it is a lot more controversial to see a grown man naked than it is to see a naked baby.
Uh-huh.
But I think it ultimately comes back to the same sort of argument over breastfeeding in public. It's non-sexual nudity, so why are you complaining?
Yeah. And plus, the album was supposed to be an artist impression. To just to lower that to a debate about pornography and stuff, that just, yeah.
I think it's an important discussion to have, because you don't want to see somebody taking photos of naked children, sexualizing them, and then saying, it's okay, it's art, because in that case, you know, the children are still being abused. But in this case, I don't think there's any real abuse going on.
Nah, no. Yeah, yeah.
And that's the, we'll wrap up our political segment there, but speaking of babies, have you ever played Roblox, DJ?
No, but I do watch a couple of Roblox videos.
Okay. Hopefully not those weird role-playing ones made for, like, six-year-olds.
Nah. I watch the fun ones, like the World's Biggest Slide and, yeah, those crazy ones.
Okay. Well, it's obviously designed for reasonably young children, but people have been making mass shooting replicas in Roblox. And that just reminds me of something that's been happening basically since games have been a thing, even when it hasn't happened. You might remember that the Columbine shooters were accused of making a copy of their game in Doom, a copy of their school, sorry, in Doom, and practicing in Doom, which is totally realistic, to train for shooting up the school, which turns out didn't happen. They never actually made the map.
Yeah, I heard it was a bit of a fake. It was a controversy. Like they were big fans of Doom and Quake.
Yeah, which isn't a bad thing. But if I'm remembering correctly, So they did make maps, but okay. Eric Harris did say that he had created a map of the school in Doom, but that map has been lost to time. But I think it's pretty silly to say that Doom is a training tool. But anyway, people were replicating mass shootings like the Christchurch shooting in Roblox, which is aimed at young children, unlike Doom, which is very clearly not. So Roblox say they removed it as soon as it was brought to their attention and suspended the user who created it. And along with a generic, we do not tolerate racism, discrimination, blah, 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 blah. And they have a stringent safety and monitoring system, which is continuously active. But I do keep hearing about Roblox missing things like that. So I don't think Roblox has enough people moderating content. They don't seem to have that much content being actively uploaded. But anyway, that's one Roblox story.
I mean,
you've probably heard Sorry, go on.
I was gonna say. It's also a dying game in a sense. I mean, yeah, sure, there is a big following, but it's not as big as like say Minecraft, for example.
Actually, this article says 43 million daily active users. Okay, so maybe there is more content being pumped out than I thought. Probably is, but at one point I was looking at using Roblox to do some prototyping and maybe create a little game and put it out there and see if I could make any cash off it. But it turns out Roblox has one of the worst creator share percentages in the industry. So we've all talked about how Steam and Epic take a 30% cut. Well, 30% is pretty standard. Let me just pull up the article again because it's decided to close itself. So, yeah, on Steam, you make 70% of your revenue. On Epic, you get 88%. On Apple and Google, also 70%. On Roblox, you get 24.5%.
Ah.
How wow. is there such a big gap? Why is Roblox so bad at paying their creators? Because Roblox as a game probably wouldn't exist without the creators.
I mean, what do they spend the remaining on? Is it like...
I don't know. But the interesting thing is, they have a way to push your game to the top of the discovery algorithm. It highlights 1,000 or so games on the front page, and you can pay Robux, which is the in-game currency, bought with real-world money, to feature the game on the front page by bidding for an ad slot. So we've got a game targeted at children that children can easily create in that pays bugger all and then demands more money with an auction system, which is, you know, getting up towards a kind of gambling. And then your game isn't guaranteed to be successful. To actually make money from Roblox, you need to be a Roblox premium subscriber, which costs $5 a month.
Damn, this game is like a ramped up version of Fallout 76.
It's just nickel and diming you all the way to the bank.
It's like, oh, you want to add in a new player? Money, please.
Yeah, I think that's ridiculously exploitive.
But, yeah, with the whole, like, replicating shootings and stuff, like, it's stupid that they're doing that, though. Like, why do you want to replicate that? Why do you want to replicate it in the game and post it out to the entire world? Like,
some people are messed up.
Yeah.
I think that sort of stuff starts with a messed up mind to begin with.
Yeah. And the stupid part about this whole thing is that we were earlier talking about how video games violence it doesn't really exist, and yet here we are, just like there's this person doing something.
Yeah, well, I think if you're creating a map based on a real world event, there's probably also something going on there. Although there are people who made the Super Columbine Massacre RPG, which I have played a bit of, and it is a game inspired by the Columbine Massacre, where you play out the massacre in the role of the killers. I saw it at a Games as Art exhibition, which was about, you know, sort of pushing the limits of what can be considered art. But I think you've got to be a little bit cuckoo to actually want to do that in the first place. And I can definitely see the concerns of glorifying real-world criminals.
Curiously, I'm just though,
astounded at how exploitive Roblox is.
From a game developer's perspective, though, whenever you see these incidents like that and seeing how exploitative the platform is, like, do you ever get the whole idea that, yeah, I really hate game development at times?
At times, yes. I'm frankly very pissed off that Roblox is doing this, because especially in the last couple of years, there's been a big push to pay the developers better. And if Epic and Steam can afford 30% or less of the revenue, why does Roblox feel the need to take 75.5% of the revenue from developers? You also can't cash out until you have about 1,000 real world dollars in your Robux account. So
this is ransom. This is daylight robbery.
Yeah. They're basically putting you out to create content for them and then making it extremely difficult to actually make any money off that content. And I think that's wrong. Roblox wouldn't be the massive cultural hit it is if people couldn't create content for it. So they're just taking their content creators and milking them for all they're worth.
The question would be, though, are they using, you know, these are they using the school shooting reenactments as ways to get money off?
Actually, the article doesn't say whether the school shooting, sorry, the massacre, Christchurch massacre, was monetized or not.
Oh man, if it was monetized, oh lord. You would have seen a lot of people get really cheesed off at them.
That would have probably made it even worse.
Oh yeah. I mean, YouTube has some very strict content as well. Like, if you were to like reenact all these like events and stuff like that, they will stamp, they will crush you down hard. And
why you gotta be like this, Roblox?
So moving forward from this, though, do you reckon we should see more and more control over game development as in general when it comes to recreating what real world events kind of thing? Like, let's say, okay, Columbine Massacre, bad. But let's say if you want to recreate, for example, the... name a big event that's... Pearl Harbor, for example.
Not so bad, because Pearl Harbor isn't in living memory anymore.
But it's a real-world event, nonetheless.
But nobody remembers it happening. Like, apart from a handful of people. But we're approaching, 79 years, I think, since Pearl Harbor. And that means that anyone who was old enough to actually remember Pearl Harbor is approaching the average life expectancy. So I think it, like, as a bit of a joke, tragedy plus comedy, tragedy plus time equals comedy. And things being too soon, like 9/11, too soon. Pearl Harbor, not too soon. Vietnam, there are games about Vietnam, not too soon. Because those are the sorts of things where the people involved are less likely to be around anymore. There are games set in the Middle East wars, which themselves are a bit iffy because a lot of people, you know, Afghanistan only just ended after 20 years. So all these games that have come out in the past 20 years in the Middle East have been about wars that people have actually lived through and are still alive. And sometimes those games try to tackle real-world events there, which they don't do very well. 6 days in Fallujah, or Fallujah, I'm not sure if you pronounce the J in that, is coming out soon after 9 years since they put it on hiatus. The developers say they don't think they need to show the atrocities in one of the most controversial wars in the past century. And I think that's the wrong way to go about it. I think if you're going to represent a event like that artistically, you need to acknowledge the atrocities. In this case, they're just taking the Battle of Fallujah, which is a very significant battle, and kind of making light of it. It's a couple of years old now, but one of the newer CODs had the Highway of Death, which was when the Americans bombed a massive column of retreating soldiers during the first Iraq War, I think, which an absolute bloodbath. Hundreds of people died, and there are still people who would have lived through that because it was only 30 years ago. The newer COD game called that a Russian atrocity, which I think is absolutely bloody ridiculous and just downplays the severity of it. And basically says that the US can't commit atrocities. So I'm getting off on a tangent, but I think if you're going to make a game about a war, then, or an atrocity like the Columbine Massacre, then you need to acknowledge the atrocity and deal with it artistically, rather than trying to paper it over or make it look like the other guys did it.
Yeah, yeah. And there is it makes it making these sorts of things. You're glorifying the event rather than.
Yes, glorifying the event. That's the other thing that I'm concerned with. I think there's a way to handle. So I think the further you get from living memory, the more leeway you can have with. The more leeway you can have with creating a less accurate portrayal. So the Battle of Hastings, you can make a game about that and could do whatever you want with it. And I don't think you'd really offend anyone. I don't think you'd be doing too much of a disservice to the people involved. But I think Yes, there is an element where you can glorify an atrocity, and I think as game devs, we need to be careful not to do that when we're creating art based around real-world events, because the people in those events are real people. They have real lives and real stories to tell about the events, and we need to be careful how we handle it so that we're not dismissing the issue or harming the people who were involved. I've gotten way off on a tangent there. And should probably get back to a advertising break and then on to our shout-outs and events of interest.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So, for our shout-outs this week, we have on the 21st of August 2021, Nick Davatzis, I'm sorry, I can't pronounce that, the founder of the A&E Network and History Channel. He passed away in Wilton, Connecticut. I remember we used to have the History Channel in the early 2000s, and my grandpa still has Foxtel, and wow, it's gone downhill.
Really? How so?
Yeah, so it used to be a lot of documentaries. These days, it's either all documentaries about World War II, so it gets the name the Hitlery Channel. although they don't call themselves History Channel anymore, now they just call them History. And alternatively, they have crazy stuff like Bigfoot hunting, Oak Island money pit digging.
Really? That's a thing?
Yeah, yeah. So basically reality TV shows pretending to be history. I wonder what Nick would actually think of this, because he promoted educational outreach. Bob Iger actually said he was a towering figure in the early days of cable television, who helped build some of the most iconic brands in the media landscape. He was a person of true integrity. I love a good documentary, though.
Yeah, that
and
even though history has gone into reality TV territory, there are some good shows in there. I got addicted into Forged in Fire. Man, that show is addictive. Where it's just
okay,
a guy's building.
It's not really history, though, is it? It's a reality show.
Yeah, that's the downside, yeah.
Yeah, it's more of a reality show than a history show. Sure, Making Swords is historical, but it's a thin veneer over the actual substance of the show, which is a reality TV competition.
Yeah, yeah.
On the 24th of August, the drummer from the Rolling Stones, who would probably kill me for saying that, Charlie Watts, passed away at 80. So the reason I say he would probably kill me for calling him the Rolling Stones drummer is that he once was woken up in the middle of the night by Mick Jagger, who wanted to speak to his drummer. He shaved, had a shower, got dressed in a suit, went down to Mick's room and punched him in the face. He said, "Don't ever call me your drummer again," and went back to bed.
It's like all that time shaving and dressing up a suit is like, yep, screw that.
That's a lot of effort just to go and punch someone.
Yeah. Apparently, so in 2003, he expressed regret about that incident, attributing his behavior to alcohol.
Well, probably also being woken up at like 2 a.m.
There were some other incidents as well. Like there was one time that the band got invited to the Playboy Mansion. And while everyone was frolicking with women, Watts took advantage of his game room.
Like, I mean, arcade games?
I think he meant like the trophy game. kind of thing, you know.
Yeah,
he never which he quoted, "I've never filled the stereotype of the rock star." And in a 1996 interview...
No, it's an arcade.
Oh, okay.
Filled with pinball and arcade machines, a pool table. You can find pictures of it online.
Nice, nice. And in 1996, he said that he had sketched every bed that he slept on while on tour since 1967.
Weird hobby, but okay.
Yeah, but he wasn't really a fan of the lifestyle, wasn't he?
No, he sounds like an interesting guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely not a stereotypical rocker.
Yeah, he wasn't really interested in the girls screaming at him and being chased by girls.
He also collected cars even though he didn't drive and would just sit in them in the garage. And on the 25th of August, Linux turns 30. You have spelled that wrong, DJ. It's Linux. Not Linus. Or Linus. I think it's actually pronounced Linus, which technically makes it Linux, because it's Linus's Unix. But I first learned about Linux before I knew how to pronounce his name the way he likes it. And it's indelibly stuck in my mind that it's not Linux. So it was sort of a spin-off of Unix. He wanted it to be compatible, but he planned it to be free and open source. And he says that if he'd planned it better, he wouldn't have called it Linux because... There we go, I just did it again. He wouldn't have called it that because he didn't want people to think he was an egomaniac. He'd planned to call it Freaks, I think, is how you would say that. Freax. But the first Linux administrator said that was silly, so they changed it back to Linux, even without knowing what Linus would have wanted. It's pretty crazy that it's come from just a bit of a hobby he had to literally the most common operating system on Earth, because it's on every Android phone. It runs on a bunch of embedded systems. Microsoft wished they could have that much reach.
I don't understand, though. Like, even though Linux is more known than Windows and Mac, why hasn't Linus got all the credit / wealth from it?
Because there's no wealth to make from it. It's a free program.
Yeah.
The wealth comes from things like Red Hat, which basically the Red Hat company created a custom Linux distribution which had custom software, and they maintain it and offer support on a subscription, of course. The money to make is from supporting Linux, not for developing it. Although it does turn out that the majority of Linux devs are actually paid to do it, because there's a lot of value in supporting Linux. Not just from Red Hat, the NSA has supported it as well. They created security-enhanced Linux, and that's mostly been backported into the main branch. Not that I'm sure I would normally trust the NSA, but since it's all open source, everyone has an opportunity to have a look. I do wonder, though, there's so many lines of code, how many of them have actually been reviewed by people. And for our remembrance, we have William Herschel on the 25th of August, 1822. He was a German-born British astronomer and composer. He collaborated with his younger sister and fellow astronomer, Caroline Lucretia Herschel. He constructed his first large telescope in 1774 and spent 9 years carrying out sky surveys to investigate double stars. In 1802, he published a catalogue of 2,500 nebulas, expanding that to 5,000 by 1820. And his telescope model was so good that he could tell that nebulae in the Messier catalogue, so back then there was no central repository of star data, but the Messier catalogue counted as nebulae what were actually clusters of stars. So a nebula is a cloud of dust, basically. And on the 13th of March, 1781, he discovered a new object, which is a planet with the most embarrassing name, Uranus. No, it's Uranus. It was the first planet to be discovered since antiquity. So up until Uranus was discovered, or Uranus, if you want to pronounce it that way, so you don't say anus. all of the other planets were known to ancient people. And that's why many of them have Roman names. The Romans knew about most of the planets. As a result of the discovery, George III appointed him court astronomer. He was elected a fellow of the Royal Society and pioneered astronomical spectrophotometry using prisms and temperature measuring equipment to measure the wavelength distribution of stellar spectra, which is really interesting because there's lots of things you can tell by looking at the wavelength of the light coming from a stellar object. You can tell what kind of gas it's made up of, what temperature the star is. It's all really cool. He also discovered infrared radiation. The discovery of Titania and Oberon, moons of Uranus, named after Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, and Enceladus and Mimas, moons of Saturn. He was made a knight of the Royal Guelphic Order, I think, in 1816, and was the first president of the Royal Astronomical Society. He died at the age of 83 at Observatory House, and his epitaph is Calorum Parapit Claustra, which is Latin for "He broke through the barriers of the heavens."
Oh, what a nice epitaph.
That's a great epitaph. On the same day in 1819, so a bit of overlap here, Alan Pinkerton was born. Now, he's best known for creating the Pinkerton Detective Agency. He first became interested in detective work while wandering through the groves around Dundee looking for trees to make barrel staves when he ran into a band of counterfeiters. After observing their movements, he informed the local sheriff. He became the first police detective in Chicago. In 1850, he founded the Northwestern Police Agency, which later became Pinkerton & Co., and finally Pinkerton National Detective Agency, which is now known as Pinkerton Consulting and Investigations. The Pinkerton logo was a wide-open eye with the caption, "We never sleep." They're famous for solving train robberies. He was also head of the Union Intelligence Service during the U.S. Civil War, protecting Abraham Lincoln from assassination and identifying troop numbers in military campaigns. Which all sounds all fine and dandy, but it turns out that all this work he did training agents has led to the Pinkertons now being Union busters.
Oh.
Yeah. Apparently Pinkerton was pretty pro-labor as a young man, although he opposed strikes and distrusted unions. And now Pinkertons are hired by companies like Amazon and Facebook to break up union people. They're not the most popular people among the left-leaning society.
Can you imagine the Pinkertons at Riot Games and Blizzard Entertainment?
Actually, did Blizzard hire them? I think Blizzard might have hired them. I vaguely remember seeing this the other day. Yes, back in July, they hired the Pinkertons.
Oh!
Which, you know, it's a pretty obvious sign that you're going to try to stop your workers unionizing at this point. But they hired them to do an internal investigation. Whatever that means, which could totally just be investigating employees likely to form a union.
Not to mention suppressing evidence, as recently revealed.
Yes. The Blizzard executive team should all stand down. As well as Yves Guillemot from Ubisoft. Are there any game developers who aren't horrible people anymore? Me. I've just got to actually get around to releasing another game. And for our event of interest, on the 25th of August 1957, the film The Invisible Man vs. the Human Fly released. It's a Japanese film by Mitsuo Murayami, starring Ryuji Shinagawa and Yoshiro Kitahara. And the plot summary: a serial killer with a peculiar method of stalking and killing his victims comes face to face with a police officer turned invisible by a scientific experiment.
This is like King Kong versus Godzilla all over again. It's like, who will emerge triumphant?
Yeah, in English, it was called The Murdering Mite. And the movie known in the West as The Fly, the famous one where Jeff Goldblum turns himself into a fly accidentally, that is a Great movie. Horribly gory, but great. I remember seeing it once when I was home alone, and then the sequel was on because it was a movie marathon, and my parents walked in during the only sex scene.
And that's how the professor became the professor.
The Fly was released in Japan as Fear of the Fly Man. The Invisible Man vs. the Human Fly predates the... Oh no, I'm thinking of a different The Fly movie. I'm thinking of the one from the 80s. The one we're talking about here is the one from 1958. So The Invisible Man vs. the Human Fly beat The Fly by a year. I haven't seen the original The Fly, but I understand it's a lot less body horror because he actually just gets turned into a fly rather than going through the whole slow transformation. And finally, on the 25th of August 1989, Voyager 2 made its closest approach to Neptune. At the time, Neptune was the last planet in the solar system because Pluto passes within the orbit of Neptune. So the observations from Voyager 2 were able to prove that there was no unseen planet, although that idea has come back into back in vogue recently. But the the orbits of Uranus and Neptune were incorrectly calculated because the mass of them was incorrectly measured. The Voyagers are some of my favorite spacecraft. I love the stuff they've got on there, like the map to find Earth. It's just really interesting to me because it's like if you were trying to communicate with someone. I think it's why the movie Arrival clicks for me so well, because if you're trying to communicate with aliens with no common language and no common experience, how would you do so? Turns out the best scientists we have decided that the answer was measuring the rotation of pulsars to find the Earth and communicating time by using the frequency of a helium atom. You can actually find recordings of the golden records on the internet too. Well, that's all we have for tonight. Where can they find us, DJ?
They can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, thatsuckcanon.com. We have an archive of our old episodes. And they can also find some new That's Not Canon podcasts, such as WTF is Happening, the podcast. Join us, Maddie and Nick, as we rant about the latest film, TV, music, and pop culture moments. We're overflowing with opinions, both valid critiques and downright ridiculous pet peeves. So come along for the role, because it's sure to be hilarious.
Sounds fun. Well, that's all we have for tonight. So look after yourself, stay hydrated, and we'll see you next time.
See you next week.
Here we go!
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.